This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. On this March Madness Day, when illegal gambling on college basketball takes America by storm, in every office, it seems, Connecticut lawmakers are considering a big expansion of our state's legal gambling enterprises. It's a plan that has support from many lawmakers looking to save state jobs, but it comes with many questions. Today on Where We Live, we welcome in chairmen from the Mohegans and Mashantucket Pequots to talk about their plans to work together and build more state casinos to compete with competition coming from Massachusetts and New York. We'd like you to join the conversation with your thoughts and questions, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome into our studios Rodney Butler, who's chairman of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Council. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And Kevin Brown is here. He's chairman of the Mohegan Tribe. Thank you so much for coming in, Kevin.
Thanks very much, John.
First of all, I'll give you folks a chance, and you can take turns. You've probably been tag-teaming this for a while now. What exactly would this bill in the legislature do, and how do you propose to work together?
Well, the legislative language right now suggests that our tribes, under the structure of the current gaming compact that we have with the state of Connecticut, could open up to three more gaming facilities in the state.
And that's essentially what it is. And your plan then would be to open up three more gaming facilities in the state.
I think that's open for debate. I think what's great about the language as it has been structured is it allows us to begin that conversation about whether the right number is three, two, or one, but at least it recognizes the market demand in both Massachusetts and New York with the upcoming competition from destination resorts that are going to go into those two states.
And we've been hearing state lawmakers talk about a war with Massachusetts economically. We heard Martin Looney at the very top of our program play some – we played some tape from him talking about the competition coming from up north. And Rodney Butler, there's an impetus, it seems, by many to at least get something built on the I-91 corridor between Hartford and Springfield in advance of this big MGM casino being built in Springfield.
Yeah, clearly that's the driver. I mean, that's where this conversation started. I mean, they're breaking ground this week on that facility, and that's going to impact, by their own numbers, 45% of the current gaming market in Connecticut. And so we have to do something to combat that, as well as take advantage of the opportunities throughout the state.
What can you tell us about the market as it is? We've heard numbers from various analysts who've said that Connecticut could lose thousands of jobs and Connecticut could lose hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue. What are the numbers that you're seeing, and where specifically do you get those numbers?
Well, we've hired a third-party analyst to look at this for us, and is actually the individual that did the reports for the Massachusetts gaming law. That was really the key force behind that gaming law, Dr. Clyde Barrows. And so he presented to the Public Safety Committee earlier in this week, and I'll have a full report out next week that goes into detail about how we determine those numbers, or how he determines those numbers independently.
Go ahead.
And, you know, as we await that final report, we can use history as our guide. History always informs us. And look, over the last decade, there has been an increase in gaming in the Northeast region. About a doubling of the number of Class 3 gaming locations. That doubling of the market has resulted in a reduction in the employees at each of our facilities over that same 10-year period. So history guides us and tells us that, you know, we're not making this up. It's not overly dramatic. It is real, and it is here. More competition will ultimately result in the reduction of employees at our facilities as we resize and recalibrate our business models.
Yeah. So, something else has been happening, though. The total amount of money that people are spending on gambling has been going down as well over the course of the last few years. Frankly, since the Great Recession, fewer people have money in their pockets. You've both seen a downturn in the economy. You've both seen a downturn in the amount of money that you take in at your casinos right now. How can we possibly say that the models looking forward are going to be that we're going to have more people wanting to gamble as opposed to fewer, which seems to be the trend?
Well, I think the challenge that we see in Connecticut and from a public perception in Connecticut is that people are looking at Connecticut numbers. And in fact, it goes back to Chairman Brown's point that the Connecticut numbers have been declining substantially because of the surrounding competition. But when you look at gaming as a regional, from a regional perspective, the overall gaming market has grown over the past few years. If you incorporate from Maryland up to Maine, which is really the same market that we're all competing for.
If you look at the Barrow report that is out in its current form, and I'm sure it'll be in the update as well, and I'm sorry for referring to a table number for folks out there that haven't looked at the report, but it's emblazoned in my mind. Table 2 or figure 2 in that report shows over the last decade or more that actually in the region gaming has continued to rise with a little dip during the recession, but we're still on the way up. And so, at the end of the day, yeah, this is really about an equilibrium point. You know, we're all competing for the same market share. And as you would address it in any industry or business, we're just making sure that we can continue to compete.
Well, one of the things, and we're talking with Kevin Brown from the Mohegans, Rodney Butler from the Mashantucket Pequots, and we're talking about plans to expand casino gambling outside the traditional tribal areas in the state. It's an effort by these two tribes and also state lawmakers to, in theory, compete with Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, other places where there's gambling all up and down the eastern seaboard. I'll ask you both. You both, though, are involved in gambling outside this state. I believe right now, Rodney Butler, there's a plan that you're looking at in terms of gambling in Massachusetts, right?
Right.
Actually getting into one of these casinos. A lot of people in Connecticut would say, why should we help you expand in Connecticut if you're trying to take jobs away from us right now by building a casino in Massachusetts?
Well, it's not taking jobs away, right? So the facility that we're looking at and very loosely looking at in Massachusetts
is in the southeastern
region. And so when you look at demographics and distance, which really drives gaming these days, it's all about convenience and relative distance to the facility. That facility is so far out of our region that there's really no real impact to that to the Connecticut market. And so if we were looking in Springfield or just over the New York border, that would impact the Connecticut market. But the way that we look at it, it's an opportunity to actually grow the market in general and drive people back to our resorts here.
Just help me understand that again, because it does indeed, though, increase the amount of gambling activity in Massachusetts. And while I'm sure you've done studies about how far people are wanting to drive to go do this, at the end of the day, it does build more capacity in the state to the north where they've made these big investments, not here in Connecticut where we've already made big investments. And so it seems to many people, I would think, that you're drawing jobs and or money away from Connecticut casino gambling into Massachusetts casino gambling if you get into business with them.
Right, but if you own that additional capacity yourself, it's easier to maintain the jobs and revenue that you have than it is to compete with somebody else who would own that.
That's right, and I can reinforce that for Rodney. You know, we faced the same question when we were going before the Mass Gaming Commission with our pursuit for a Revere-based casino, Boston-based casino, and the same question came up. And what we tried to make everyone understand is, why would we go about pursuing a license and developing a facility in Boston that we wanted to be successful and have our home-based facility not be successful? We would have marketing approaches that would ensure the success of both facilities. The same thing would apply here.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Ricky's calling from Shelton. Ricky, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, my name is Ricky Looking Crow. My question for you is this. I have a concern. The casino expansion, I believe that, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Indian gaming casino should be only on Indian land. Am I correct or am I not?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep. If it is a Native American-owned and run business under IGRA, it would have to be on the reservation.
Okay, so it would have to be. So how can it expand to, you're saying, Boston, when it's not the reservation? I know the Mohicans, I know the Pequots, and that's not their land. So how is the advancement of casinos into other areas on white land?
Well, it's commercial gaming, so it's no different than MGM or Wynn or Trump or anybody expanding into gaming throughout the region.
Just like it's no different than the current facility that we as the Mohegan tribe own and operate in Pocono Downs in Pennsylvania. It's a commercial venture.
But into Turkey's question regarding Connecticut, so part of what the legislation that lawmakers are considering would do is allow you to operate outside of the tribal areas within the state of Connecticut. Is that correct?
Correct. But those would be commercial ventures.
They would be commercial ventures.
Right.
Do you currently have any plans or any designs on any land in the towns of Enfield that we've heard about or any place else in the I-91 corridor that is right now being targeted as the first place for one of these casinos?
No, that is the next phase of this for Rodney and I and our business teams to look at the laser focus of where do we want to go and exactly what do we want to do. We're right now only at the beginning of the stage of the conversation that the legislation would allow for us to do it. The next step is to do that due diligence.
Just talking about that, something that we've looked at is the fact that, say, in that corridor, in Windsor Locks, there's an OTB facility. It's right next to where I park my car when I go to the airport. And so that's already an approved gaming space for an approved use. It's something that's been there for quite some time. Obviously, the people who run that would like to maintain their business or grow their business. We have similar parlors like that for OTB, I believe, in Bridgeport and New Haven. Bridgeport has been another one of the places that has been talked about as a potential expansion for you folks. Why not just work with the folks who already operate approved gaming facilities, OTBs, in places like Windsor Locks or Bridgeport in order to expand them so as to not build new facilities?
Well, I mean, what we're saying, we're not saying we are or aren't going to work with them. What we're saying is we have a very successful relationship between both tribes and the state that have been beneficial, substantially beneficial to all parties for the last 20 or so years. And so let's improve upon that. Let's expand upon that. And let's work within that framework as we approach this bill. And then once we have the bill moving forward, then it'll all be an exercise in a math to say what is the location, the structure of the facility, the relative distance from the highway, all that. What is going to be the best economic impact for and job preservation impact for everyone involved?
What is this facility? What is it going to look like if we build one? We'll just talk about this first one again that seems to, in many people's minds, need to go up very quickly because Massachusetts is breaking ground in Springfield right now in their casino. Kevin, what would this place look like? What would it be like?
Let's talk about what it's not first. What it is not is it's not a destination resort like you see currently at the Mashantucket Pequot's Foxwoods location or Mohegan Sun. It won't have a hotel and an arena and multiple entertainment venues. Also, what it is not a slot parlor, as some like to call it. We're looking at a medium-sized first class. I mean, let's keep that in mind in this conversation. I heard some of the conversation on the show yesterday. Well, this is going to go up quickly, and it's just going to be a low-quality product. We run two of the world's premier gaming facilities. We would not go about doing it that way. It'll be a medium-sized first class location that might have, in the range of, say, 1,800 slots and 75 tables in it, and probably a couple of restaurants, food and beverage-type amenities as well.
Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, as Kevin was saying, I mean, it's really just going to be a high class facility for that regional market, right? And so, we don't need a big entertainment facility. There's not going to be, Bon Jovi or Aerosmith going there. But if there's something in the area, i.e., hotels in the area, or a venue in the area that can host large shows, I mean, that would be a benefit to the location, absolutely.
So one of the things that over the years, southeastern Connecticut has benefited from is because you have Bon Jovi or Aerosmith or anybody else showing up at your facility, and you have high-end retail and you have these nice casinos, it's seen as a destination that actually has some ancillary benefits to the rest of the area. Mm-hmm. The question I'd ask is if you have something that, even if it's a high-class place that's a nice mid-sized casino, if it doesn't have some of these other ancillary things, does it do anything for the surrounding town? If you build it in Enfield, what does Enfield get out of it?
Well, they'll get thousands of jobs.
Thousands of jobs, property taxes, and a revenue stream that's guaranteed by the legislation as it's currently written, though it's not definitive about amounts, and that's some of the hard work to come. That location would also, at the municipal level, see some income as well.
Union jobs?
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about. This is not on the Indian reservation, and so that is open for discussion as well.
When you say open for discussion, what does that mean? If it's off the Indian reservation, it seems as though it's a pretty good possibility. We're talking about union jobs, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that includes 1,500 union construction jobs to put the facility up if we were to go greenfield.
How much does a place like this cost to build?
It depends. I mean, if you look at what Penn National is doing out in Plain Ridge, their facility is about $225 million. And that's probably a relative range, somewhere between $200 and $300 million, roughly. And again, this is early estimates.
Right.
It could increase based on, again, the economics of it, or could decrease. But that's pretty much a relative range.
Yep. Is the building operation of this solely financed by the two tribes? Is there any state money that comes into this?
There is no state money. I'm glad you asked that question, John, because that seems to be a default for folks who are either against or neutral about this right now. They think that somehow this is a public-private venture. This is a commercial venture by the two tribes. We're all in. The state is just only allowing for it by legislation.
And again, maybe some of the business dealings are a little different because we're essentially dealing with sovereign nations operating outside of their tribal areas. But any tax breaks, tax forgiveness like the government does for other businesses that want to expand in the state?
No. In fact, just the opposite. I mean, as we have a requirement under the current gaming compact with the state to provide 25% of our slot tax revenues back to the state's general fund, that will be in play here as well to include the potential for taxation of the table games as well.
Right. I mean, to that point on the taxation of the table games, that is unique about this, right? So that the slot tax clearly only applies to slots and nothing else on the reservation enterprises. We do pay state liquor tax and sales tax and so forth. So all that will apply. All the state taxes will apply. And in this case, it does apply to table games as well, which will require some level of negotiation. But to your point, I don't think we're going to get any tax credits.
And like I love the way you teed that question up, John, and you saw our response to it. I mean, as we look at this as a business decision by the state, you know, what we are suggesting is that our business, our industry, is reaching an equilibrium here in the region. And what should government do to ensure a competitive market when it comes to any industry that's in equilibrium? Well, taxes or regulation or deregulation to help assist and ensure that it remains competitive. Well, if we're going to do that for UTC in terms of tax breaks, we can't ask for something like that. All we're looking at is to maintain our competitive edge, and the way to do that is to, I suppose you could say, deregulate by not having us only allowed to game on our reservations.
Can I ask you more about the jobs piece of this as we talk about equilibrium? So we employ right now thousands of workers in southeastern Connecticut, and in both tribes, both casinos, have expanded greatly into other ventures outside of gaming in the last several years. Mohegan Sun building a big hotel. Foxwoods, I think right now, a job fair today is being held to fill 900 jobs. This is for your retail mall.
Yeah, opening May 21st.
Okay, so opening May 21st. So I guess what I'm trying to understand is how this works, where if you have fewer people from Hartford, for whatever reason, let's say Hartford and New Haven, driving to your casino, in part because the casino economics have changed. We've seen that happen over the years. In part because there's a lot more competition in the casino business. Some people are going to want to go up to Springfield or elsewhere. Aren't you going to lose a lot of jobs in southeastern Connecticut? Maybe displace them to Enfield or someplace, but aren't you just going to have to cut jobs in southeastern Connecticut? There won't be as much business there. That's what your analyst is saying.
Well, no, because what we're doing between their hotel and our outlet mall that's coming online, there's going to be 900 jobs, permanent jobs at the outlet mall, right? And so we're going to continue to reinvest in our properties to make them true resort destinations. So beyond that, I mean, there's concepts of indoor water parks and adventure parks and all those likes. And so those are opportunities where we're going to continue to add jobs, just might not possibly be specifically gaming jobs.
Right. And that's, you know, as anybody who's followed the industry has recognized, non-gaming ventures have become an important component part of the amenities that a casino provides. And that's where we're focused. And we're going to keep building and changing the landscape of our flagship properties. We're going to sustain ourselves. I heard mentioned yesterday on the show something about the fact that, you know, we were only trying to survive and that this wasn't really about jobs. Let's be very real about this. The last 10 years has demonstrated that we know how to ensure that we continue to survive. We have to dial back. We have to rescale. And the ultimate payer of that are those jobs. That is what this is about. And by doing both, by ensuring that we can meet the convenience gaming demand, which is one portion of our market share, and the destination resort demand, which is another component part of our overall market share, we can do both, and we must do both and not be cornered into one or the other.
But I just want to understand a little bit more that convenience gaming demand versus reserve. I mean, what do we know about the customers specifically? I mean, I know right now a lot of people from the greater Hartford area, the area you're targeting for a more convenience casino, a lot of people go down to your resorts to spend money. And they don't just spend money gambling, pulling mm-hmm. slot handles. They also go to shows. They mm-hmm. go out to basketball games. They put money back into the southeastern Connecticut economy. So aren't you, just by the very nature of what you're doing, essentially saying to some of these people, don't go down to Mohegan Sun, don't go down to Foxwoods, stay here in Enfield and gamble?
No, absolutely, because not. Just like what you said, John, you said they're going there for the shows, for the incredible dining venues, right, for the golf, for the spas. All that is still going to be there and more at the resort destinations.
You think people in Connecticut right now in our economy have the money to be doing all this stuff, be spending all the money down there on all this stuff, and then going up to Enfield and making sure that they gamble a little bit too?
Let me give you a story about Yonkers Raceway.
Yeah.
The short answer is yes. This is the state of Connecticut, after all. Let's keep that in mind. But secondly, Yonkers Raceway, not the most premier facility on the planet, started to take some of our market share from our Mohegan Sun Destination Resort Casino. So we did a focus group. We wanted to know why that was happening. Mitchell Ettis, our CEO, actually sat in and led and guided that focus group. And he asked him, well, where do you like to game? They said, where are you gaming? Well, we're going to Yonkers Raceway. Where do you like to game? Well, we like to go to Mohegan Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why do you go to Yonkers? Because it's convenient. But they were doing both. For their convenience gaming needs, they were going to Yonkers Raceway. But when it came time to see a show, get a bite to eat, have a weekend out with friends, they still would return to the resort destination. You have to be able to service both components right. of this market.
Right, and we've seen the same. We've had the same experience with the opening of Twin River in Rhode Island, right? Mm-hmm. So they're more of a convenience facility. And what we see, if you go there, I'll run into some of our patrons, and they're almost ashamed to see me. But they're say, "Hey, Rod, you know what? We're still visiting your facility on the weekends. We're still going to the shows. We just go a little bit less, right?" And it goes back to my earlier point: if you can own that competitive environment, then you benefit from it, right?
And we can drive it through our marketing.
Right.
So, and we're going to have to take a break in just a moment. We want to get to some phone calls. We've got a state lawmaker on the line. But one thing that you seem to be signaling, which is obvious, is a lot more states, a lot more municipalities, tribes, they all want to get into the gaming business. And that's why we're having this conversation right now. Massachusetts decided we're going to build more casinos. Rhode Island, Yonkers, they're all up and down the East Coast. I would assume if that's the trend, then there's just going to be more. There's going to be online gambling. The state of Connecticut talked about Keno last year as a way to balance our budget, and it sort of didn't go anywhere, but a lot of lawmakers are still saying, well, Keno might be something we do. 5 years from now, if we have competition from online and more people are building casinos everywhere, are we really going to have the market, the ability to be able to get people into these new facilities that you're building, given all the options that they have?
Yeah, well, that is a challenge, and that's why we need these facilities, right, so that we can stay competitive, because they are going to go to Springfield. They are currently going to Yonkers and Queens. They're currently going to Twin River in Rhode Island. So, you know, having that facility that can capture a portion of that we're going to lose anyway is the point.
Right. On a supply and demand curve, when you look at that intersection and you find the competitive price point, there is no entry fee to go to a casino. The price point is how far do I have to go? That's the price point, and that's what we're working toward right now.
A quick call from Josh here, who's calling from West Hartford. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
I just want to thank Mohegan and Foxwoods for making Connecticut an actual, you know, have some excitement going on in the state. I think Hartford would be a tremendous place for a joint venture. You know, increasing the outside atmosphere, revitalizing the city, building shops with residential units above them, and then, you know, kind of two casinos that kind of encompass the whole Civic Center, the XL Center, for a potential Whalers in the next decade to come back. I think it's a huge opportunity for the city.
Josh, thank you very much. So Josh wants to build it right in Hartford.
Yeah, Josh, first of all, thank you for that recognition. You know, it goes unsaid so often, but there's so much that we and our employees bring to the state beyond the entertainment experience. But we appreciate that so much. But, you know, Hartford is a great location, right? I mean, that's in that Hartford region that we're talking about. We haven't settled in on any particular area, but I will say that, you know, the city has done a great job reinventing itself. With the landing and with the Civic Center and now with the, I guess, there's a baseball team coming to town.
Yeah, the Yard Goats are coming. I know you guys are excited about that.
So that wasn't a joke.
That's really happening.
Okay. Yeah. No, but the revitalization, and, you know, maybe we can be a part of that.
Yeah.
And Josh, you know, again, just to reiterate Rodney's thanks to you about recognizing the excitement we bring, come on down for a New England Black Wolves lacrosse game Sunday, the 29th of March at 1 p.m.
That's just very nicely woven in there. Kevin Brown is chairman of the Mohegan Tribe. Rodney Butler is chairman of the Mashteca Pequots. When we come back, more conversation with them. We'll also bring in State Senator Tony Huang, a Republican who represents the 28th District, who has some concerns about this plan. We'll be talking more about lawmakers, talking with the tribes about more casinos in the state. What do you think? 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we welcome in Rodney Butler and Kevin Brown. They're respectively the chairman of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Council and the Mohegan Tribe. They're working together to try to bring more casinos to the state. They're working with lawmakers very closely. We've heard the voices of lawmakers over the course of the last few days in the show, thinking that it's time to engage in a battle for jobs with Massachusetts. Tony Huang is a state senator who represents the 28th District, someone who does not believe that this is the way the state should be going. Tony Huang, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to this bill?
Well, I think the first point is I do want to extend my appreciations for what the tribal casinos have contributed in regard to tax dollars in our state. But my concerns are particularly in addressing the issues that when they talk about this as a major push for jobs, what came out in the public testimony a couple of days ago is really not really a creation of new jobs, but really a maintenance of the current status quo. And I think we've heard so many times, and I think you've addressed it earlier, is the fact we are potentially looking at an increased competition for a significantly declining marketplace. And I think the other major argument that's been raised is the fact that, look, if Connecticut doesn't do it, what's going to happen when Yonkers in New York and Springfield, Massachusetts opens this up and takes money away from us? Well, the reality is it's a shrinking business. It's a shrinking marketplace. And the reality could possibly be that in 2 years or 3 years that they could experience in Springfield and in Yonkers and possibly in Rhode Island, that the mirage of gambling may just simply be that. We have seen the incredible demise of communities and the lure of gambling of Atlantic City. Look at the commercial gambling vision that's become the reality, that is urban blight and challenges of really despair. So I think we have to be very, very careful in the potential concern of racing into a faltering industry that may potentially be unsustainable. And more importantly, I think the thing that doesn't get addressed in all of these concerns is, what are the real potential societal costs that is not measured?
To talk a bit more about, Representative, what you believe the societal costs are, because you raise the specter of Atlantic City. It's something that I think I've talked with Rodney Butler about before in the program. The fact is that gambling is not always a panacea for communities, and sometimes it's far from that. That is one example. Maybe you can talk a bit more, Representative, about what you see as the problems with bringing gambling to any community.
Well, I think that's a very critical question. The medical community has acknowledged that gambling addiction is an illness. And as a result of that, the opportunity to expand gambling and bring it to literally the doorsteps of our communities outside of tribal land really increases the opportunity of building potential new populations and cadres of gambling addiction. I mean, I think you prefaced early on your show that we have March Madness, in which people have gotten engaged with the brackets and the pools and how it's taken away from a lot of productivity. But it is an informal form of entertainment engagement. But can you imagine the opportunity to bring that as an everyday fare, literally to the doorsteps right off of 95 or 84, to have people engage in it, that people that may have a propensity to gather or sustain or an addiction, that we are taking that right to their doorsteps?
Well, and let me get some response from the tribal chairman here. Kevin Brown, go ahead.
Well, Senator Wong, thanks for your impassioned concerns. I mean, I can't say that they're not important, but I also can say that it's not like we aren't attuned to them. We are great partners with the Responsible Gaming Framework and the Problem Gaming Committees, and we recognize it. Let's keep in mind and let's sort of bound this conversation with the recognition, not to underwhelm it, not to walk away from it, that 2.8% of our patrons could be considered problem gamers. And we are laser-focused on it. We have employees who are trained to recognize the problems with problem gaming and learn to cut folks off. I like to pitch a vignette. Our director of table games recognized one of our players walking off the floor, head down, slung low, walking away, engaged him, said, "Hey, what's going on?" He said, "I've hit my credit limit. I'm going to the credit cage. I'm going to extend my credit limit." Now, if we were a dog-eat-dog, money-focused organization, we would have said, "Okay, we'll get you to the cage." That director of table games sat that guy down, talked to him for an hour, and told him, sort of talked him into taking a break. He walked away from gaming. He took a vacation. When he came back a year later and said, "Hey, I'm better," he reduced his credit limit for gaming. We're very, very cognizant, is the point of sharing that vignette with you, of our problem gamers that are out there. But I wouldn't want the general public to think that by putting up a casino, we have suddenly created the beacon for all problem gamers to come run.
One thing that you've said to us One thing you've said to us already is that the key to this plan is making it more convenient for people to gamble.
That's correct.
Okay, so if you have a certain percentage of people who take the trek to go to southeastern Connecticut and they have the money in the car to get to southeastern Connecticut,
right.
And that's 2.8% of your population.
Right.
If you put it, as the senator suggests, on someone's doorstep in the town next door where you can take a bus or where you can get somebody to drop you off, that does seemingly make it much more convenient for a lot of people who probably shouldn't be in your casinos, right?
Well, I don't know about the shouldn't be part of it. However, you know,
if they're problem gamblers with right. a true addiction problem, they probably shouldn't be in a casino.
Well, no, you're right, and they shouldn't be. And we have mechanisms to address that.
Yeah.
But the point is, the overarching umbrella to all this is that that convenience is going to be 20 minutes from here in Springfield, and we're going to lose that.
Right.
So we can do nothing and lose the revenue and those jobs, those thousands of jobs, or we can do something about it. And that's what this conversation is really about. We've been addressing problem gambling. We've been partners with them for 23 years now at Foxwoods and at Mohegan for 20 years. And so we value that partnership. We work on it consistently, and we're very focused on it.
Let's be intellectually honest here. We are in the state of Connecticut. It's 140 miles wide and maybe 75 miles tall. We really aren't talking about any drastic change in the convenience that would drive sort of the social ills. We're talking about convenience for those folks who would on any other given night perhaps go out and have a drink, have a dinner, watch a movie, spend $150-$200 on some other form of entertainment. That's the other 98% of the folks that we're talking about here. Let's not lose sight of the overall conversation.
Senator, you want to jump in?
I appreciate that. And the point that was made, and I appreciate both tribal casinos' contributions to the Connecticut Problem Gamblers organization, and I appreciate that. But here's an interesting part that was raised earlier. We are talking about an addiction. And what's fascinating was the example that was brought up of somebody who had an addiction issue and was noticed and was pushed aside from the table. But they went back. And one of the symptomatic concerns when you look at it, because of a medical illness perspective on this now, is when you have an addiction in alcohol, you are to not drink ever. We are looking at somebody who has a possible gambling addiction, but the opportunity is so pervasive around us. And we could potentially increase that population, because one of the testimonies that came out is, in order for that model, that business model to succeed, there has to be a greater number of people that will engage in gambling. And I think what was brought up in regards to the residual values of that is we have not had a significant comprehensive study on the consequences of gambling's impact on communities. As Congressman Bob Steele in the 2nd District had mentioned, and seeing that since the 20-year expansion of gambling in the southeastern Connecticut region, he has seen the effects mm-hmm. of potential increases in fraudulent crimes and white-collar crimes. But the challenge of that is we, in all of this talk, have not really addressed the increased need. If gambling was to be mm-hmm. made available throughout our state, what are we as a state and the commitment that we have to help those people with the possible addiction?
It's a great question.
Very quickly,
Senator, hold on, because Rodney Butler wants to jump in. I'd like him to answer that question.
Yeah,
that you just
thank you. And again, thank you, Senator. We share the same exact concerns, and that's our commitment to problem gambling and that small percentage of the population that is affected by that. And we don't just remove people or walk them out and say, hey, take a break and come back and gamble in an hour. We exclude them from the property.
That's right.
And we have people who self-exclude. Their family can exclude them. And then we have very, very high-tech surveillance systems where we track people, facial recognition and so forth, where in our controlled environments, we can identify someone who's been excluded, send over security, and remove them. So we're not just simply letting them back in. But when you think about that in comparison to the gambling throughout the state, those people with addictions can go every 10 feet to a convenience store, a gas station, a liquor store, and first of all, buy their liquor. Secondly, they can purchase now $2 Powerball tickets, and they buy them, you know, $100 at a time, especially now that the odds are extremely unfavorable to them. That, you know, these jackpots get up to $100 million, $200 million, and they're spending their whole paycheck on
which,
that.
Which, interesting.
With no secure method to identify those with addictive behaviors and address them.
Which is exactly why in our public hearing just the other day, it was identified that it is in fact the lottery that produces the largest portion of the problem gaming population because of that lack of restriction and regulation. You can go to the store, buy a gallon of milk, buy a lottery ticket. And to your question or point, Senator, about what is Connecticut going to do about it, I'd just like to highlight, and this may be a statement of the obvious or the already known, but the legislation as written, the proposed bill as written, makes sure that this commercial venture in which we will put forward the money to raise and run has a revenue stream to enhance the Connecticut Problem Gaming Council's efforts to get after this very issue that we're talking
about. How much money are we talking about going to the problem gambling folks?
That's all going to get worked out in the details.
Yeah, the details are not in the language.
Because they're dealing with a very thin, I don't have the numbers off the top, but I mean, they're dealing with a budget that's very small for what they're trying to do. As the problem, as the senator, I think, suggests, gets bigger potentially with more people gambling at more places, we should probably think about how we truly expand their ability to do their work.
The revenues from the Connecticut Lottery last year eclipsed what the state was receiving from both facilities. Collectively, we provide more to Problem Gambling Council than the Connecticut Lottery.
And if I could add one more thing,
just about the concern about the social impact of this.
Yeah.
And what we've had a tremendous relationship with the municipalities in our region, and you can go to any one of them and ask them about their relationship and the impact that we've had on the community. Now, gambling 30 years ago, and John, we've talked about this previously, I mean, the models were different 30 years ago, right? It was just build something. Who cares about the surrounding community? We just want to suck all the money out. Well, that's not what gaming is today. Gaming is truly a partnership with the community, these integrated resorts. And to a testament to that is just yesterday, the Southeastern COG, which is all the regional council of governments, all the municipal leaders in Southeastern Connecticut, voted unanimously to support this bill.
These are the impacted communities right now from our two facilities.
Right.
There's been no incredible demise. And while there's no argument that, you know, there is a different nature potentially of the type of crimes that occur in and around the region, this is a council of governments that recognizes that there's been no demise in Southeastern Connecticut in the municipalities.
And Senator, go ahead quickly before we have to take a break. Yep.
It's a very important point that they bring up. They have been good neighbors, but there are residual effects because of the illness of gambling. But I will add, I know that both of these gentlemen have mentioned the Q polls result, but one of the clarification that needs to occur is that there were two sets of questions. I think the first set of questions where people did recognize the integral part of gambling and the tribal's impact on it and approved of it. But the second set of questions was, do you support expansion of casino gambling? And the numbers were remarkable, 4-1 against. So what you see is the fact that we recognize in over 20 years that gambling is part of our fabric in Connecticut. But what you also saw in people is the fact that they do not want that expansion. And one of the most compelling testimonies came from people, everyday people who said, look at me. Do I look like a gambler? This was a middle-aged woman who is somebody's potential grandma, and she said, I'm a problem gambler. I lost everything. And the things that I did. So one of the concerns is the 2%+ that you talked about being addicted in gambling, I do not believe it truly reflects the real number of the problem gamblers that are doing this in secret. And my real concern is the potential opening, because in any business model, you need to have more people buying into it. And that's my real concern.
Well, and let me just let Kevin address that concern, Senator, before we have to go to a break.
We've had the conversation, I think, already. Interestingly enough, that testimony yesterday at the public hearing was from someone that we're well aware of and very engaged in. She understands the problem from the Connecticut Problem Gaming Council's standpoint, and she's a good partner. She'll tell you right up she's not a pro or anti-gamer, but she understands the problem, and that's the common ground that we have here. We are aware, focused on, and mindful of what our responsibilities are.
I want to thank State Senator Tony Huang, who joined us today by phone. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Senator.
We're going to head to a break in just a moment, but I just want to quickly ask something that we didn't get to. When it comes to the partnership with the towns, Who's responsible for law enforcement? And right now at your tribal casinos, you are responsible mm-hmm. for law enforcement. If you build in Enfield or some other town, I just keep saying Enfield because mm-hmm. that's something that's come up. Who's responsible for policing in and around the casino?
Well, like any other commercial business in any municipality, it would be that municipality. And that's why we would pay, you know, property taxes and so forth that go for those services.
Have you had specific conversations with some of the towns that could be affected here, the municipal leaders, you know, in these towns that you might be looking at?
Nothing specific. I mean, some have expressed interest unofficially, but no specific conversations.
The senator mentions that Q poll. I mean, there's a lot of ways to read some of the numbers. Overwhelmingly, people say, you know, look, we don't want a casino expansion. I know, Kevin, you've said that you can read the numbers a lot of different ways. Here's one thing that seems pretty clear. You ask the question, you want a casino in your town? People say, nope.
Right.
How do you read that? I mean,
the not in my backyard, the NIMBY syndrome. Clear and fair. However, at the end of the day, let's not lose focus on what this is about. It's about jobs. And if you take the logic trail from the question that says, do you approve of the job that the tribes have done in gaming and what they brought to the state? And the answer is yes. Do you want expansion of gaming? And the answer is no. Well, the logic trail needs to go one more step. And that same Q poll says, what is your number one concern here in the state of Connecticut? And it's jobs. You know, the senator opened up by saying that he was sort of mystified by the fact that what we weren't talking about was creating jobs, but only maintaining jobs. Well, to me, that's important. We need to maintain jobs in the state of Connecticut, and that is really what this is about.
In a state that's lagged the entire country in job growth.
I want to get to one quick phone call before we go. Bill, hi, go ahead.
Yes, I just wondered why that was like the Mall of Minnesota. Why not put a casino right within the shopping centers, especially when they said they're going to put water parks and what have you out in this Buckland Hills Mall in the last 20 years? It's exploded. The people have got the money if they're going to Brooks Brothers and L.L. Bean and make it a destination of such as Mall of America.
Bill asked a question about that. There's already shopping there. There's already infrastructure to get people in and out of there. Why not there?
Yeah, look, Bill, thank you for that one. We're not stuck on a location, right? I mean, that's a great idea, and we'll evaluate all that when we get to that point, but appreciate that.
When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking more with Rodney Butler, chairman of the Mashantucket Pequots, Kevin Brown, chairman of the Mohegans, taking some more of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266 about expansion of casino gambling in our state. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, from the Israeli elections to Iran's nuclear program to the Islamic State, there's been no shortage of news coming from the Middle East lately. On tomorrow's program, we'll catch up with some of the latest headlines. We'll take a look at Benjamin Netanyahu's victory in Israel, and the Atlantic's Graham Wood will fill us in on what ISIS really wants. That's tomorrow, Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking with Rodney Butler and Kevin Brown, chairman of the Mashantuckets and Mohegans. They're working together to try to bring more casinos to the state, try to keep jobs in the state of Connecticut, they say, jobs that may be going to Massachusetts or other places as Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York all expand their gambling operations. I want to play for you a little bit of tape from one of your colleagues, somebody who gave testimony earlier this week at this hearing. Richard Velke is the chief of the Scaticoke Tribal Nation. They have for years been pushing for federal recognition. They, of course, have state recognition. Many people have thought that if indeed they get federal recognition, they would want to open up their own casino in the state. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Does this legislation is drafted restrain free trade? How does Connecticut protect against time and money consuming lawsuits from commercial gaming companies who would see this bill as restraining interstate commerce and potentially being antitrust in nature? Or is this a tribal gaming-oriented law? Will it automatically accommodate other tribes as they become federally recognized? Or will that just lead to latent litigation?
So I'm wondering if you can address the two questions he asks in order. First, talking about the interstate commerce piece of this. If indeed this law passes and Steve Wynn, you know, Donald Trump, whoever wants to build a casino somewhere in the state, can't they just walk right in and start negotiating with town and do it?
Well, here's the start point for the conversation. Currently, what the legislation proposes is within the structure of the existing gaming compact that the state has with both tribes. And so this is no violation of that or in the other direction, a violation of any kind of interstate commerce. As far as the tribal recognition and gaming aspect of it. I heard some of that discussion yesterday as well, and my fear is, you know, yesterday as I listened to the speakers talk about it, the comments made were something to the effect of, this is about the ego of the big gaming Indian tribes, and if this was truly in the spirit of tribe-to-tribe conciliation, in fact, they played my remarks where I said that about our tribe-to-tribe conciliation partnership, then they would not be, you know, trying to get this venture underway. I'm kind of offended by that because the words that were used, well, this is just rhetoric. What I consider to be rhetoric is when people misinform the public by conflating the issues of federal recognition with Indian gaming. Those are two separate and distinct issues. Certainly one follows the other, but they are not one issue together. And so we have always been on record as saying that we would never, ever stand in the way of the federal recognition of a tribe that deserves to be recognized. And we remain in that position at this point. Gaming is a whole other topic down the road.
Yeah, and in particular with the state-recognized tribes that remain, we, both Mashantucket and Mohegan, have sent letters of support on behalf of those tribes for their recognition. And as Chairman Brown points out, the challenge is this is really a national issue, and just the bringing the recognition issue with the gaming issue together as one, it's completely separate. Recognition is about an inherent right, inherent sovereign right for tribes, right? And all that comes with that, and to self-govern, access to great health care and educational benefits and grants and supports for building their communities. That's
first,
what it's really about.
First and foremost. But unfortunately, those things have been conflated. I think it's very fair to say, and this isn't about you folks, this is about the state of Connecticut.
Yeah.
Both our federal lawmakers and the state lawmakers have for years, it seems, and you can correct me if you think that I'm wrong, worked pretty hard to make sure that you guys were the two federally recognized tribes and were also going to be entered into an agreement with you two to do tribal gaming in the state. The fact of the matter is Connecticut has spent quite some time and quite some money saying we don't believe that there are any more federally recognized tribes other than these two in the state of Connecticut. And so if I'm Richard Velke, the Scaticokes, the Golden Hill Paugussets, or anybody else who's been trying to get recognition for these years, I can only look at this and say the state's been trying for years to keep me from getting recognition for all those things you just said, not just for a casino. And here they are striking a deal for these two tribes to do stuff off Indian land. That just doesn't make sense.
Right. And again, from our perspective, it's different than the state's perspective, right? So I don't understand the state's perspective and what's driving them. But from ours, it's really about their inherent sovereign rights. And we support those through and through.
Yeah. And most of the recent conversations, at least, about federal recognition have centered around the standards for it. And what we've always said is that, you know, we had to go through a very rigorous process to achieve federal recognition, and we feel that those standards existed for a reason, and everyone should be subject to them. I don't know that the state necessarily has a position other than that right now, but as Rodney said, I can only speak for how we look at it, and that is, you know, federal recognition is a process of ensuring that we have passed all the right gates, and we have.
If indeed, we just have a minute or so left, if indeed this law passes as written, and Richard Velke's tribe does get federal recognition, would they be then allowed under this law that you guys are working for to open up a Bridgeport casino if they want?
Well, under the current compact, as occurred back in 94, 95 with Mohegan, when they were federally recognized, they had to talk to both us and the state, right? And so that same process would occur as new tribes, as additional tribes would get recognized in the state.
And I guess the question, too, I think what he was raising is, are you essentially drafting a law that carves out a niche for just the two tribes that are currently federally recognized? Shouldn't this open up the opportunity for gaming to all tribes? Just a very quick answer. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's under the guise of IGRA, right, for federally recognized tribes. So we don't control that relationship with IGRA and state-recognized tribes.
Yeah. Okay. That's probably another long conversation for another day. But this conversation went far too quickly. I want to thank Rodney Butler, chairman of the Mashantucket Pequots. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
I also want to thank Kevin Brown, chairman of the Mohegans, for coming in. Thank you so much, sir, for coming
in. Thank you very much, John.
If you want to continue this conversation online, go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Interns today, Julia Pistel and Kelsey Bissell. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.